Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about an interdisciplinary approach to reducing Oklahoma's rate of women that are incarcerated, and in Tulsa specifically. Women are the fastest growing population being incarcerated here in the United States, a majority for simple drug offenses, and Oklahoma's rate is twice the national average and leads the country. My guests today are the founders of Still She Rises, which takes what's called a holistic defense approach for mothers accused of crimes. At Still She Rises, each client has access to a team of attorneys to defend the accused against charges, advocates to protect her in housing and family court, and social workers and advocates that support them in finding benefits that are due them in counseling, substance abuse treatment, or child care. This holistic approach that examines and intervenes in the root causes for the individual's involvement with the criminal justice system was pioneered 20 years ago with great success by founder Robin Steinberg when she founded the Bronx Defenders in New York City. Steinberg is a leader in indigent defense. She joins me today, along with her colleague Patrice James, also a veteran of the Bronx Project, in bringing this approach to North Tulsa with Still She Rises. Still She Rises is voted to mothers in North Tulsa that are involved with the criminal justice system and bringing that holistic approach to the area. They join us today on Studio Tulsa. Robin and Patrice, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Still She Rises follows over two decades of experience working in New York City and the Bronx with the Bronx Defenders, where there it looks like you were serving a whole community of people in a full range of criminal work, social work, a whole range of specialists working with the community. How did Still She Rises come to Tulsa with this focus on women who are engaged with the criminal justice system?
So Still She Rises is the first replication of the model of holistic defense that we've been practicing up at the Bronx Defenders for the past 20 years. What holistic defense really does is recognize that somebody who comes into the criminal legal system is more than just the criminal charge that they're facing. They come into the system for a variety of underlying issues, and that those issues need to be addressed, whether those issues are drug addiction, whether those issues are family violence, whether those issues are just living on the margins of society in poverty, whether it's related to over-policing in a particular community that's been targeted by the police. But we recognize that those issues drive people into the system, and then once they're in the system, they almost never have just a criminal case that they're facing. There are interconnected systems that are usually involved in the lives of low-income people, and particularly low-income people of color.
For example, if you're in public housing, an arrest jeopardizes that housing completely, correct?
Your job is jeopardized. Your housing is jeopardized. Your potential immigration status is jeopardized. Your children, being able to kiss them goodnight, is actually jeopardized because DHS can come in and take your kids with criminal legal involvement. And so the holistic defender model is really created to look at all of those issues and provide advocacy and defense and support in the whole host of issues that are both driving people into the system, but also the collateral impact of that criminal legal system involvement.
Obviously, Tulsa is a great model for replication of this process, but there's actually a focus because of our high incarceration rate for women. It's the highest in the country. And so the focus has been on women as opposed to a whole community.
Right. So we brought this model down with the hope that we could address some of the reasons that women are coming in contact with the criminal justice system and the child welfare system so much.
You know, what isn't abundantly obvious to everybody is that over the past 30 years, the number of women in jail has increased by 700%. So nationally, you know, we have statistics about that the fastest growing population in jails and prisons in this country are women. Oklahoma is twice the national average in terms of incarcerating women and girls in the system. There are now 225,000 women in prison and jail. There's 1.2 million under the criminal justice system control. So this is a big problem and it's growing. The holistic defender model is really designed to reach into and look at why are we having an uptick in women in the system, and when they're in, what are the unique impacts of women in the system, 80% of whom are mothers.
You've been here on the ground about a year here in Tulsa, Patrice. What have you found as far as the reason women are in the system? This is a huge uptick.
Right. We see our clients have high levels of poverty. Many of our clients have zero income coming in. If they do have any income coming in, it's usually Social Security of some sort. Our clients have very little formal education. And also we see that our clients, because of where they live in North Tulsa, they are pretty much isolated. Transportation is really poor. are almost non-existent for many of our clients. There are no grocery stores. There aren't many jobs that can pay our clients livable wages. But also our clients have little formal training in terms of employable skills.
Now, the isolation issue, public transportation has lagged behind in the city for so long. Can you give us a sense of what that means for addressing some of those core issues? Poverty, zero income, little education. There's no way really to get out of that cycle if you're literally on foot.
Exactly. We, at this point, our office has a van, and we use that to get our clients back and forth to court, to connect our clients to any sort of services or treatment providers that they may need access to. I mean, essentially, to get from our office to the courthouse, it's maybe an 8-minute drive, but could be 2 hours on a bus. And so the idea that our clients are going to go downtown for this particular service or go out south for this particular service or this grocery store, it just doesn't happen, which there's been a lot of talk in the news right now about the number of dollar stores in North Tulsa. But that is actually where our clients have to grocery shop at because there's nowhere else for them to go. So there are all these things that are playing factors into why I believe Oklahoma is incarcerating so many women and why women just can't get from underneath these systems.
So let me ask you a bigger question. You were working, I assume, the South Bronx, which is also an impoverished area, although it's kind of changing in New York these days. But
Everything in New York is changing. But yes, the Bronx
is the lowest income community
in New York City.
But what are the differences you saw from that particular place to what you're seeing in North Tulsa? I mean, what has struck you as the biggest difference?
I mean, I think what strikes me most is actually the similarities. Okay. I think what you see is that marginalized communities and communities of color that are low income feel the weight and bear the brunt of the criminal justice system. They bear the brunt of the child welfare system. They are carrying the weight of the interconnected systems that are grinding them and their families up, not just when they have cases pending in the system, but long afterwards. One of the things we did when we first got down here, because we thought it might be very different, was we wanted to really hear from the women in the North Tulsa community. And we did a bunch of focus groups, and we collaborated with the Tulsa Artists Fellowship so that we could actually hear the stories that women had to tell us, to teach us, educate us, so that we could elevate their stories and respond to their needs as they defined it, right? And one of the things we learned was how much similarity there is, how when you come from a low-income community, when you come from a marginalized community, even when it is resilient and where families do the best they can and where love is abundant and faith is clear, that communities that are isolated and marginalized have a very hard time navigating the systems that are involved in their lives. And we see it over and over again with the women that we represent and the women that we defend. And so, yeah, there are some differences. I guess the most striking difference is New York City has a social safety net that actually is designed to help families and keep them from falling through the cracks. We don't see that same social safety net here in Oklahoma or in Tulsa.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of those case histories. You did speak to a lot of people in the community. We have some clips to play which sort of address that issue of this whole feeling of being targeted and feeling like there's a breach in the community between the support of the community and law enforcement of the community and the community. But what are some of the things you learned from hearing these case histories, if you will?
I think that there is a lot of distrust of the systems, a lot of distrust of police officers, and a lot of concern over the way people feel that their community is sort of policed and surveilled. I also think that people just feel the extreme weight of these systems. We spoke to so many people that just owe the court systems hundreds upon thousands of dollars or have outstanding warrants for traffic tickets, but just have no way to pay those fines and those fees. We heard a lot of people who feel exhausted and tired and are not sure if Oklahoma is the best place for them, but sort of have no way to transition to anywhere else. And so feel sort of trapped or stuck here.
Why don't we hear some of those recorded case histories that you've been working with the Tulsa Artists Fellowship and collecting. This is two women that you'll be hearing during the show, just portions of their story. And we're going to start with a young lady named Asia and then another Kay who are going to tell their story.
Right now it's summertime and we don't have anywhere for the youth to go. And so there's going to be police officers in the neighborhood. Interaction with the police is very intense. There is a lot of racism here in Oklahoma. they might come up to you and ask you, what are you doing? And I'm like, I live in this neighborhood. Well, where do you stay? I'm like, I'll tell them where I stay. And they're watching you. And it just feels like someone's waiting for you to mess up, like you're a target.
The justice system is unfair because there's just no African-American people there. There's just white faces. Once they have you in their system, you're in there.
Don't judge until you know the whole story. I'm not sure what I'm going to do, but I feel like Oklahoma might not be a good state for a mom and kids.
Well, you get a sense of some of the issues they're dealing with and that breach in the community. How deep is this breach? How hard will it be to repair?
The breach is extremely deep. And, you know, I'm not sure how you repair it at this point. Obviously, reforming the system is a start, but people aren't going to necessarily feel any better as they're going through it. You know, there's been a lot of talk in the city about community policing, but we actually haven't seen much movement on that. And so right now, I think the community just doesn't believe that that's something that's going to happen or ever going to exist here in Tulsa.
It's important to remember that the majority of women that come into the criminal justice system do so on what we all consider nonviolent offenses. They're related to poverty, theft, drugs, things that actually don't really impact public safety or where there aren't actual victims involved. Mm-hmm. That those behaviors are often the symptoms and the result of prior trauma, prior sexual abuse, mental health issues, the kinds of things that drive most women into the system. The system was really designed for men, and until we begin to actually back up and look at the system through a gender-specific lens and recognize that women coming into the system suffer with unique impacts on the system and address those, we're not going to really begin to address the issue of women's incarceration in Oklahoma. The bright spot is that women's incarceration rates, as they continue to grow and climb, both in this country and in Oklahoma, have actually been decreasing in Tulsa. That's the only bright spot I can add to this at the risk of depressing everybody.
Yeah.
Tulsa is actually really thinking about this issue carefully. The George Kaiser Family Foundation has been doing work in this area. People in the North Tulsa community have been thinking about this issue and how it impacts women from that community. So there are some bright spots about reforming the system.
And, you know, your holistic justice approach is sort of being replicated in other ways in the community, whether it's in incarceration intervention processes. And when you look at the state has a lot of the legal mechanisms to provide for this sort of approach. I mean, you've got the state questions that passed, the Justice Reinvestment Act, but there's never been any money put into creating this support network that you're trying to do on a private level, on a private nonprofit level. So when a person comes in contact with the criminal justice system, they come in contact with you, you're talking to criminal defense attorneys. You're also, you know, if they're living in public housing, that public housing may be endangered. DHS may be involved. Give us a sense of how the system works in holistic defense.
So we have a team of 14 full-time staff attorneys and advocates who work together. That team consists of criminal defense attorneys and housing, civil advocates, a social worker, an investigator, people all working together to really look at where are the systems impacting our client and how can we provide advocacy and defense in all those different areas? And how might we be able to stabilize her family so that, you know, system involvement doesn't happen again?
And if there is a child in the home and an arrest, does that automatically get DHS involved?
Sometimes, more often than not, the police officers will call DHS. And usually the charge that will follow that is usually a child neglect charge for having something in the home, which, you know, DHS could immediately remove, and it could take, you know, I think the average time to get a child returned to a parent in Oklahoma is 16 months. So that's an extremely long time to have a child away from their parent.
And one of the things I think people are uncomfortable talking about, right, is if you police one community and you don't police other communities, what you may see is that there are children in homes with parents that have drugs in the house. But what you don't see is that other communities in Tulsa have the exact same problem. So if you went out south, for example, my guess is if the police surveilled and policed those communities equally, they would find plenty of families that are raising their children and doing a pretty good job, even if there are drugs in the home or alcohol abuse in the home. It's not necessarily a disqualifier to being able to raise your child and keep them free from risk. But the more important factor is that the lens is really only being turned on communities like North Tulsa that are predominantly low-income people of color. And until we grapple with that, we're never really going to reform the system.
I mean, that sounds incredibly important, but how do you even broach that subject of disparity without turning, you know, the people involved in law enforcement, you know, they just put up a stone wall when they hear that? How do you breach that wall of saying, look, you're treating one part of the community very different than you would another part of the community?
Talking about race is complicated and uncomfortable for all of us. Yeah. But unless we begin to grapple with the disparate ways that we treat low-income people of color, as opposed to white affluent communities, we're never going to get at the heart of this, right? We need to really begin to have those conversations around kitchen tables, right, in town hall meetings, at the political level, so that everybody in this community can feel as if they're being treated fairly and that their communities are being policed fairly and that we're not really relying on bias and stereotypes about certain communities that don't hold. And frankly, I think if you were to look, you know, at the nation as a whole, you realize that drugs are prevalent everywhere. But drug possession is only being policed in low-income communities and low-income communities of color. And that's just not fair. And I don't think any of us want to be in a criminal justice system or a policing system that targets only some communities over others.
The Bronx Defenders cite a statistic that about 1 in 3 people that are arrested are actually never charged with a crime. One of the reasons they take this holistic approach, because even though you're arrested and you're not charged with a crime, you spend some time in jail, you have all these collateral damage to the family, you know, DHS or what the equivalent of DHS might get involved. So can you maybe discuss some of those collateral damages? What are the consequences of an arrest, even when there's no charges filed?
So it's important to remember that even a few days in jail can completely destabilize a person's life and their children's lives. It sounds like, oh, it's just a few days in jail, but it's never just a few days in jail. That initial time in jail where you're being held on bail or bond, and it's important to remember, you have not yet been convicted of anything. You are only charged with something. It's an allegation. But people are being held in jail cells on bail that they can't pay. And during that period of time, while they're waiting for their cases to get through the system, they're losing their jobs and their homes and their children. And that collateral damage and the cascade of destruction that happens begins to happen immediately before anybody's been convicted and there's even been a determination whether or not somebody's guilty. It's why the bail and bond schedule is so onerous, particularly for low-income people, because the damage actually happens before there's even been a finding of a crime.
There's a lot of talk about having a bond reform. If you do have a run-in with law enforcement, there may be 30 days or something like that, but there's also a fine with it. The inability to pay that fine can keep you in contact with the criminal justice system for well beyond whatever, you know, minimum sentence or sentence diversion or probation got you in contact with law enforcement in the first place. Is that something you found that's pretty common?
Absolutely. I was in municipal court this morning where, you know, a client owes probably $300-some-odd to the courts and just cannot really get that money together. And so, you know, for me, if I get a ticket and owe $300, I can pay that today and be finished and done. My client, she's been coming back to court for almost a year because of the amount of money that she owes. And so people just can't get the system off of their backs, mainly because they are poor. And the same happens with bond, as Robin was speaking about. People actually here in Oklahoma, their case can be finished and resolved, but they are still making monthly payments to bondsmen. And so it's just another bill that people are tacking on, people who have no money. I have a client who recently just got evicted because she had to make a choice between paying her rent or paying her bondsman. So people are out here really struggling.
And that can be, even if the case is resolved, they may still be paying the bondsman off on a monthly payment system.
Absolutely.
And failure to pay that bond can result in rearrest?
Honestly, I've never heard of this. It's not something that I saw in New York City, that people are still paying their bondsmen. I don't know if the bondsmen go back to court. I don't know. But I've heard the stories many times of people still paying their bondsmen after the case is over.
How important is that piece of the law enforcement puzzle to reform bond and criminal financial penalties in sentencing?
So what's clear is that the size of somebody's bank account is going to actually determine what kind of justice you get, both at the front end of the system and at the back end of the system. So if 62% of women who are in jail are there because they cannot pay bail, That means they are sitting there in a jail cell because they don't have a bank account big enough to pay the bail that you or I might be able to pay while their case is going through the system. And again, they haven't been convicted of anything. On the back end of the system, there are onerous fines and fees that are calculated against anybody coming through the system. Obviously, again, that impacts low-impact women, and particularly women of color from this community who can't pay those fines and fees. So both at the beginning of the system when bail gets set and at the end of the system when these onerous fines and fees get placed, financial ability to pay is determining in large measure what happens to people in jail, particularly the women that we defend, and what their futures look like. And that's just unfair. It shouldn't matter what the size of your bank account is, you know, about the kind of justice that you get.
My guests today are Robin Steinberg and Patrice James. Robin is the executive director. Patrice is the director of external relations for Still She Rises, a public defender's office in Tulsa devoted to representing mothers in the criminal justice system. And I say it's a public defender's office, but it's actually a nonprofit private public defender's office. And it's devoted to the mothers in North Tulsa. That's the community they're serving right now. When we were talking about collateral damage earlier, and just the fact of an arrest could mean that DHS is involved with a children, especially if it's a single parent household. We have a couple of other clips of some of the stories you've been hearing, and it gives you a sense of what that mother's going through. First, they've got their own legal problems, but they're looking at sort of the disintegration of their family.
The very first thing almost every woman that we interview when we first get her case talks about is her children. Where are they? Who's watching them? What can I do? Can I talk to them? Can I see them? Are they okay? And we take that very seriously in thinking about the kind of counseling that we can provide and get involved in that DHS case as early as possible.
Are the stories that Kay and Asian tell that we're going to hear in just a moment pretty common?
Very common. No matter what our mothers are charged with, they love their children. They want to be with their children. They don't want to put their children in harm, and many don't. Many actually have not done anything to put their children in harm. But when there's an arrest, DHS is often right behind.
Well, let's hear these clips here.
The first time was 5 years ago. I didn't really know what to do, and all I could do was text the caseworker if I could talk to or visit my kids. It doesn't matter if they work with you or not. I don't feel like they want to give the children back. It took me almost 2 years to get them. And that's hard on both the child and the parent because they're scared out of their wits. You only get to see them once a week if you're lucky. I tell them that I love them. I am not going to forget about them and that I am doing my best.
When your child's in DHS custody, you cannot talk to your children about why they're removed. Sometimes you might have your child, "Mommy, I want to come home," and you can't tell them why.
It's pretty difficult to hear that. I'm wondering, do you see disparities in how DHS works from community to community? Because in many communities, grandmothers, aunts, uncles are taking care of the kids. Is it equal treatment from community to community?
I'm not sure 100% what's happening in other parts of Tulsa, mainly because we focus on North Tulsa. One of the things you have to think about is, outside of an arrest, what are the ways in which DHS gets involved into our clients' lives? And I think you have to think about poverty. And when you are poor, what doctors are you going to? You're usually going to the clinic, right? You're not usually going to your private pediatrician. And so there's a bias in that, and bias in the way that people are treated, the bias in the way that health officials see different cases.
Can I break that down a little bit?
Sure.
When you're going to a clinic, that means that your child is seeing a different doctor every time. They don't see the continuity of care from, say, 6 months ago, a year ago, 9 months ago, a year and a half ago. Can that make a difference?
I think absolutely it can make a difference when you don't have the same doctor who maybe has a relationship with their child and knows your child's medical history firsthand versus reading just a report. A lot of times we see it with the different bruises where, you know, a client will swear up and down, "My child bumped his head," but maybe the doctor at the clinic is like, "I'm not sure. I think that maybe it's abuse," where maybe a pediatrician at a private office may just take the parent's word for it. And so there's definitely bias, I think, in that.
Well, of course, once DHS is involved and the family unit is put apart, this is creating, as you well know, Robin, this is a cycle that sort of repeats itself, destroyed generation after destroyed generation.
What could be more critical than trying to keep a family together for all of us, right? It's a thing that everybody wants for their communities. And certainly the way that the criminal justice system interacts with people and the way that the child welfare system interacts with people could come up with solutions that don't involve handcuffs and don't involve jail cells and don't involve removing children. We all want children to be safe. We all want to live in safe communities. That goes without saying. But that doesn't mean that the solution to what we're seeing, particularly with women who are struggling on the edges of society generally, that the answer is to lock them up, to take their children, and to cause more damage that will, you're right, perpetuate itself for generations. People are beginning to look at that from the very beginning of the system to the end and reevaluate, what have we done here? Why have we increased incarceration rates for mothers? When you arrest a mother, you arrest her children too.
With the history of the Bronx Defenders, you have 2 decades of work. Can you see how it's made a difference in the community? And if you had the same sort of support here in North Tulsa, do you think this is absolutely replicable here in our community?
Holistic defense is replicable everywhere, and I think it is particularly relevant for women in the criminal justice system and here in North Tulsa as well. It's a model that has proven itself to not just provide better services, better defense, better case outcomes, better life outcomes, but also to begin to heal some of the distrust and the wounds between marginalized communities who for far too long have had no access to justice or lawyers, and finally have not just lawyers, but advocates and social workers who are working together as a team and really fighting for them in any arena they find themselves. And that's the core of holistic defense.
And of course, you're also involved with the community. I guess, Patrice, that's a big part of your work. Is the community responding? And I assume when taking these oral histories, if you will, of some of your clients you're working with, sort of helps better amplify the issues. What's been the reaction from that?
The community has been very supportive of Still She Rises and is really excited to have us, I believe. People are still sort of shocked. They're like, "What do you mean? This is only for us? Like, you only represent women in North Tulsa?" And I think people are shocked, and shocked in a good way. And we were very intentional about hearing the voices of the women in the community, because you know we know sort of what works in the Bronx. We weren't 100% sure what was going to work here in Tulsa and really what all the needs were in the community. And so I think people were really happy to have something that was not just only placed in Tulsa, but actively wanting to make sure that we heard their voices and that we patterned our office based off of what they were telling us their needs were. And that's what we have done, and that's what we continue to do as we grow and expand.
We feel really lucky that we've been able to collaborate with the artists and the writers at the Tulsa Artist Fellowships who have been helping us amplify both the crisis and the voices of the women that we're defending.
I know you've only been on the ground a year. In many ways, that seems like a while, but it's probably in a huge problem like this, that's just a blip. Are you making a difference in the outcome with the clients you're already working with?
So we're incredibly proud of the work that we've done over the past year, and we can already see some of the benefits, both to the individual clients that we're working with and their families, but also to the larger legal system. You know, our lawyers and advocates have begun to do bail reduction motions, have been quite successful at getting some of that reduced so people can actually get out of jail while their cases are pending. We've been able to work with them on their fines and fees. We've been successfully able to get children returned to their moms. We've gotten people homes and their vouchers for Section 8 back. So we have seen real successes. Probably the success that matters most to Patrice and myself is that the community feels as if they have a team that really fights for them, respects them, hears their stories, and advances their agendas.
You can learn more at stillsherises.org. Robin and Patrice, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Robin Steinberg is the executive director, and Patrice James is the director of external relations at Still She Rises. You can learn more about the project going on in North Tulsa at stillsherises.org. And special thanks today to Tulsa Artist Fellows Lori Thomas and Jennifer Hope Davey for their help in providing client interviews for today's show. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.